The Chamco brothers had told them about the force screen on Cyclo's transshipment area, and that the early recoil had shown evidence of the screen's closing. The Chamcos had also told them that common salt neutralized the kill gas completely. Angus had gotten mine ventilation fans into the old base, and they'd found salt for filters of air. A group of excited, imported, awed Russians were at that very moment cleaning up the old base, and the parson was burying the dead there. And they were not about to leave Johnny McTyler anywhere but safe in that base. Dunnell Dean answered,
"What? Why not in the plane? You want to miss the victory celebration? We can't have that."
A Scot helping Dwight up in the cockpit area came back and whispered in Dunnell Dean's ear. He was dragging a mic on a long cord. They had it on the planetary band. Dunnell Dean turned to Johnny.
"They want to hear your voice so they can believe you're alive?"
"Who?" said Johnny.
"The compound, the people. Just say something about who you are."
Dunnell Dean put the mic very close to Johnny's mouth.
"I'm fine," Johnny whispered.
Then something told him he should try harder. He tried to speak louder.
"I'm just fine."
Dunnell Dean gave the mic back to the Scot, who hesitated, not sure the message had gone out. Dunnell Dean waved him away.
"I hear other planes," whispered Johnny.
With a glance at the doctor for permission, Dunnell Dean helped him turn his head. Johnny looked through the plane ports. There were 5 planes out there, stacked in a long echelon. He turned his eyes and looked out the other port. There were 5 planes out there in another echelon.
"It's your escort," said Dunnell Dean.
"My escort?" whispered Johnny. "But why? Everybody helped."
"Aye, laddie," said the chief of Clan Fergus. "But you were the one. You were the bonny one."
The doctor disconnected the tube. He felt Johnny's pulse. He nodded and motioned the others to silence. He had let this go on too long. The plane was not vibrating. The flight was very smooth. He had his patient out of shock. He wished he were in his own operating cave, but the others would not leave this young man there. And he himself, having heard but a small part of it, could share their awe and respect for what he had done.
"If you'll just drink this," said the doctor, "it will make things easier."
They held the cup to Johnny's mouth. It was whiskey and it had heavy herbs in it. He managed to drink it. Shortly the pain grew less and he seemed to be floating. The doctor signaled them all to be quiet. He had a trephine in his hand. The brain was being pressed upon in 3 places, not 2, and the pressure must be relieved. Dunnell Dean went up to the cockpit to help Dwight. He glanced at their escort. Most of them were flying with 1 pilot. They had each smashed their mine sites and come hammering back here when he put out the call for a massive patrol to the north of Scotland. They all should have gone home, but they wouldn't hear of it when they knew about Johnny. They'd gone down with a Scot war party and gotten more planes from the Cornwall mine site after shooting the few Cyclos staggering around, and those not ordered back for urgent duty had been sitting, waiting for news about Johnny. Now they were escorting him home.
"You'd better tell them he's all right," said Dwight. "They keep calling in every 2 or 3 minutes for news, and so does Robert the Fox. Takes 1 man just to handle the radio."
"He's not all right," said Dunnell Dean,
and he looked down the long corridor to where the doctor had begun the operation. Dwight glanced at Dunnell Dean. Was the young prince crying? He felt like it himself. 2. Johnny had been in a coma for 3 days. They had brought him to the ancient underground military base in the Rocky Mountains, where salt filters could be dropped into place at once if a counterattack materialized from the planet Cyclo. The hospital complex was very extensive. It was all white tile, hardly any of it cracked. The Russians had cleaned it all up, and the parson had buried the crumbling dead. 15 of the wounded Scots were there, including Thor and Glencannon. They were in a separate series of rooms from Johnny's, but one could hear them now and then, especially when the pipe major gave them an afternoon concert. Dr. Allen and Dr. McKendrick had already discharged five of them as reasonably well, and certainly too restless and impatient to keep idle when so many things were going on elsewhere. Chrissy had been in constant attendance at Johnny's bedside, and she rose when Dr. McKendrick and Angus McTavish came in. They seemed angry with one another, and Chrissy hoped they would go soon. McKendrick put a hand on Johnny's forehead and stood there for a moment, looking at the ashen pallor. Then he turned to Angus with an expressive hand that seemed to say, "See?" Johnny's breathing was shallow. 3 days before, Johnny had awakened and whispered to her to send for somebody. There was always a Scot guard at the door, his assault rifle blocking out would-be visitors, of which there were too many. Chrissy had brought him in and watched worriedly, while Johnny whispered a long message to Robert the Fox, and the guard got it on a picto-recorder mic held close to Johnny's lips. The message had been to the effect that if another gas drone appeared in the sky, they could probably stop it by landing 30 recon drones on it with magnetic skids and racing their engines on reverse coordinates so the gas drone's motors would burn out. Chrissy didn't understand the message, but she did understand that it was too tiring to Johnny. He had relapsed back into a coma, and when the guard came back to say Sir Robert sent his thanks and would do that, Chrissy was quite cross with him. The same guard was on again when Dr. McKendrick and Angus were let in, and Chrissy vowed she would reason with him. McKendrick, yes. Angus, definitely no. McKendrick and Angus went out, and the guard closed the door behind them. "Look," said McKendrick, dragging Angus into one side room after another. "Machines, machines, machines. This was once a very well-appointed and outfitted hospital. Those big things over there, I've seen them in an ancient book, were called X-ray machines. It was a subject called radiology."
"Radiation?" said Angus.
"No, man, not on Johnny. Radiation is for killing cyclos. You're daft. Those machines let you look inside the body and find out what is wrong. They were invaluable."
"Those machines," said Angus angrily, "were run by electricity. Why do you think we like this place with mine lamps?"
"You must get them running," said McKendrick.
"Even if I did, I see by that one they have tubes. The gas in those tubes is over 1,000 years old. We can't get any more of it, and couldn't get it into the tubes if we had any. You're daft, man."
McKendrick glared at him. "There is something pressing on his brain. I can't just go plunging into it with a scalpel. I can't guess. Not with Johnny McTyler. People would slaughter me."
"You want to see inside his head?" said Angus. "Well, why didn't you say so?"
Angus went off muttering about electricity. He told a standby pilot at the heliport that he needed to get to the compound fast. The pilots were very few, and they were being run ragged. They were zipping off to all parts of the world. They had a sort of international airline going that was beginning to visit every remaining pocket of men on the planet at least once a week. They were ferrying World Federation coordinators and chiefs and tribal leaders as fast as they could. More pilots were in training, but right now they only had 30 plus the two in hospital. So a casual request, even from a Scot, even from a member of the original combat force, was not likely to get much heed. Travel from the underground base to the compound was usually by ground car. Angus told him it had to do with Johnny, and the pilot said why hadn't he said so, and pushed him into the plane, and said he would wait for him to come back. With grim purpose, Angus went to the compound section where they kept the captive cyclos. A small area of the old dormitory level had been rigged to circulate breathe gas, and unreconstructed cyclos were there under heavy guard. They numbered about 60 now, for occasional ones were brought here from distant mine sites when they surrendered peacefully. Turl was captive elsewhere. Angus got an air mask, and the Scot guard let him in. The place was very dim, and the huge cyclos sat around in attitudes of despair. One didn't walk in the place without being covered by the guard. The prisoners expected a cyclo counterattack and were not too cooperative. The Scot engineer located Care and dug him out of his apathy. He demanded of Kerr to tell him whether he knew of any mining equipment that would let one look through solid objects. Kerr shrugged. Angus told him who it was for, and Kerr sat there for a while, his amber eyes thoughtful. Then suddenly he wanted to be reassured as to who this was for, and Angus told him it was for Johnny. Kerr was turning a tiny gold band around in his claws. Suddenly he sprang up and demanded that Angus give him an escort and a breathe mask. Kerr went down to the shops, and in a storeroom there dug up a strange machine. He explained it was used to analyze the internal structure of mineral samples and to find crystalline cracks inside metals. He showed Angus how to work it. You put the emanation tube under the object to be examined, and you read the results on the top screen. There was also a trace paper reader that showed metals in alloys or rocks. It worked on some wavelength he called subproton field emanation, and this was intensified by the lower tube, and the influence went through the sample and you read it on the top screen. Being cyclo, it was quite massive, and Kerr carried it for him to the waiting plane. A guard took Kerr back, and Angus returned to the military base. They tried it with some cats they had that were cleaning the rat population out, and the cats afterward seemed cheerful enough. The screen showed the skull outline very nicely. They tried it on one of the wounded Scots who volunteered, and they found a piece of stone in his hand from a mine injury, and he too seemed fine afterward. About 4 o'clock that afternoon they used it on Johnny. By 4:30 they had a three-dimensional picture and the trace paper. A very relieved Dr. McKendrick pointed it out to Angus. A piece of metal, see it? A sliver just below one of the trephine holes. Well, we'll just get him ready, and I can have that out with a scalpel soon enough. Metal? Said Angus. Scalpel? On Johnny? No, you don't. Don't you dare touch him. I'll be right back. With the metal trace paper flying behind him, Angus, 15 minutes later, charged in on the Chamco brothers. They worked in a separate breathe gas dome at the compound, industriously trying to assist Robert the Fox to put things back together. Angus shoved the trace under their pug nose bones. What metal is this? The Chamcos examined the trace squiggles.
Ferrostamonite, they said. A very strong support alloy.
Is it magnetic? Demanded Angus.
And they said yes, of course it was. By 6 o'clock, Angus was back in the hospital. He had a heavy electro coil he had just made. It had hand grips on it. Angus showed McKendrick how to guide it, and McKendrick worked out the best path to bring the sliver out with the least damage to tissue. A few minutes later, they had the broad sliver in their hands, withdrawn by the magnet. Later, the Chamco brothers identified it with closer analysis as a piece of a battle plane skid strut,
which has to be very strong and very light.
Johnny had not been conscious enough to tell anyone what he had done on the drone, and Chrissy had shooed off the historian when he tried to find out earlier. So it was a bit of a mystery as to how a sliver piece of a strut could have been daggered into Johnny's head. But whatever they had done to him, Chrissy was extremely relieved. The fever he had dropped, his breathing improved, and his color got better. The following morning he came out of the coma and smiled a little at Chrissy and McKendrick and dropped into a natural sleep. Planetary radio was not slow in crackling with the news. There Johnny was out of danger. The pipe major paraded his pipes and drums all around the compound on the heels of the crier who was yelling it out to work parties. Bonfires blazed both there and in various other parts of the world, and a coordinator in the Andes relayed the news that the chiefs of some peoples they had found there had declared this an annual celebration day, and could they come now and pay homage? A pilot standing by with his plane in the mountains of the moon in Africa had to get help from both coordinators and chiefs of that small colony in order to get space to take off again, so mobbed had the field become with celebrating jubilant people. The compound radio operators had to double up on shifts to handle the message traffic roaring in on them as a result of the announcement. Robert the Fox just went around grinning at everybody. 3. As the days wore on into weeks, it became obvious to the council, originally composed of the parson, the schoolmaster, the historian, and Robert the Fox, and now augmented by several clan chiefs, who left deputies in Scotland, that Johnny was brooding about something. He would smile at them from his bed and talk to them when spoken to, but there was something deep in his eyes that was dull and moody. Chrissy tried not to let them come very often, and when they did, she was a bit impatient with them if they overstayed. Some of the Russians and some Swedes were rebuilding parts of the academy due to the desperate need for pilots. Until the ancient Capitol building in Denver could be rebuilt, the council had a room at the academy. They could get to both the compound and the underground military base from there, and all their berthing quarters were there. At this particular meeting, Robert the Fox was walking up and down, his kilt flaring out each time he turned, his claymore held snug enough by an ancient officer's belt from the base, which also held a Smith & Wesson, knocking against chairs.
"Something is bothering him. He is not like the old Johnny."
"Does he think we are doing something wrong?" said the chief of Clan Fergus.
"No, no, it isn't that," said Robert the Fox.
"There's not a scrap of criticism for anyone in his makeup. It's just he seems worried."
The parson cleared his throat.
"It just could be his side has something to do with it. He cannot much move his right arm, and he cannot walk as yet. He is, after all, used to being about, and very briskly as well. After all, the lad had a dreadful time of it, all alone, injured. I can't think how he managed all that time in a cage earlier. You're all expecting too much too fast, gentlemen. He has a brave spirit, and I have faith."
"Could be worry over the possibility of a cyclo counterattack," said the chief of Clan Argyle.
"We must reassure him somehow," said the chief of Clan Fergus. "Heaven knows we are working hard enough on planetary affairs."
And they were. The World Federation for the Unification of the Human Race had been formed from those Johnny had not accepted for the group that had come with him to America. Some 200 young Scots and another 50 oldsters had done their beginning work well. In two dangerous but successful raids, one to the site of an ancient university named Oxford and another to a similar ruin at Cambridge, they had obtained language books and a mound of material on other countries. They had worked out where isolated groups of humans might still be and had formed up a unit for each language they thought might still be in use. Their selection was proving not far off, and ruler bruised hands attested to the diligence of their study. They called themselves coordinators, and they were making a vital contribution all over the world where groups were being found. The current estimate was that there were nearly 35,000 human beings left on Earth, an astonishing number that, the council agreed, was far too great for any one town. The groups were mostly survivors who had withdrawn to mountainous places, natural fortresses their forebears had mined, as in the case of the Rockies. But some were in the frozen north, in which the cyclos had had no interest, and some were simply overlooked strays. The duty of the council, as they saw it, was to preserve the tribal and local customs and government, and install over all of it a clan system, appointing local leaders as clan chiefs. The coordinators spread the news and were extremely welcome and successful. The hard-worked pilots were ferrying in chiefs and visitors and simply anyone who got on their passenger planes. If there were too many going or coming, they simply told them to wait until next week, and that was fine. But there was no really organized forward motion. Local control of the tribes was often slack. Some had retained literacy in their language, some had not. Most of them were poor, half-starved, ragged. The one incredible fact that after over 1,000 years there was freedom from cyclos, even if possibly temporary, united them in a wave of hope. They had once gazed from their mountains on the ruins of cities they dared not visit. They had looked upon fertile plains and great herds they dared not benefit from. They had seen no hope whatever for their dying race. And then, suddenly, men from the sky, speaking their language, telling them of the remarkable feats that led to possible freedom, had brought them soaring hope and reburgeoning pride in their race. The Council's existence they accepted. They joined it, and, with radios parked on rocks and in huts, communicated with it. They all had one question. Was the Johnny McTyler, of whom the coordinator spoke, a part of this council? Yes, he was. Good, no more questions. But the council well knew that Johnny was not an active part of the council now. Completely aside from the political significance of it, every council member was himself personally concerned for Johnny. There were all kinds of things happening over the world, most of the actions taken without even informing the council. People were moving about. A group of South Americans with baggy pants and flat leather hats, swinging wide lariats and riding almost as well as Johnny once did, had suddenly walked off a plane with their women and lariats and saddles and said, through their Spanish-speaking Scot coordinator, that they were llaneros, or gauchos, and they knew cattle, but would find out what to do with buffalo, and were taking over the management of the vast herds to preserve them and make sure the people at the compound and base were properly fed. Two Italians from the Italian Alps had shown up and taken over the commissary after making peace with the old women. Five Germans from Switzerland had shown up and opened a factory in Denver to salvage and service man equipment such as knives and tools, you name it, and if you sent it to them, they would make it shiny and working and send it back. This put a freight line into an already overburdened pilot zone. Three Basques showed up and simply started making shoes. The difficulty was that Basque as a language had been omitted by the coordinators, and the shoemakers were learning English and cyclo while they turned out shoes from the hides the South Americans dedicatedly furnished them. Many others came in. Everybody wanted to help and simply helped.
"There is no control of it," Robert the Fox told Johnny one day in the hospital room.
Johnny simply gave him a small smile and said, "Why control them?" The historian, except for Johnny's account of the drone, which was too sketchy to be called history, was getting bogged down in assembling tribal histories of the last 1,000 or more years. The coordinators sent him all kinds of stuff, and he couldn't even keep it in order. Some serious-eyed Chinese from a mountain fastness there had shown up to help him, and they were furiously studying English, but were not of much help yet. It seemed at first that language would be an obstacle, but it soon became clear that the future educated person would speak three languages: cyclo for technical matters, English for arts, humanities, and government, and their own tribal language, if not English. The pilots chattered cyclo at each other. All their equipment was in cyclo, as well as their manuals and navigation and related skills. There was a lot of protest at speaking the language of the hated cyclos until the historian learned that cyclo as a language was really a composite of words and technical developments stolen from other peoples in the universes, and there never had been a basic language called cyclo. People were glad of that, and thereafter learned it more willingly, but they liked to refer to it as techno. The parson had his own problems. He had about 40 different religions on his hands. They had one thing in common, the myths of the conquest 1,000 or more years ago. Otherwise, they were miles apart. He had witch doctors and medicine men and priests and such flooding his doorstep. He knew very well the wars that can develop out of different faiths, and he was not going to evangelize any one of them. Man wanted peace. He explained to them that man, being divided and internally at war, had advanced too slowly as a culture, and so had been wide open to an invasion from elsewhere. They all agreed man should not be at war with man. The myths, well, they knew the truth of it now. They were happy to abandon those myths. But on this question of which gods and which devils were valid, well, the parson had neatly handled the whole thing for the moment. He would disturb no beliefs at all. Every one of these tribes was demanding to know what was the religion of Johnny McTyler. Well, he wasn't really of any religion, the parson told them. He was Johnny McTyler. Instantly and without exception, Johnny McTyler became part of their religions. And that was that. But Johnny was lying a bit wan, trying each day at Chrissy's and McKendrick's persuasion to walk, to use his arm. And when the parson tried to tell him he was getting woven into the pantheon of about 40 religions, he said nothing. He just lay there, not much life or interest showing in the depths of his eyes. The council was not having a happy time of it. 4. He lay half awake in his bed, not really wanting to try. The secret behind Johnny's lethargy was the feeling that he had failed. Maybe the bombs hadn't landed on Cyclo. Maybe all this was just a brief interlude of peace for man. Perhaps soon the beautiful plains of his planet would once more be denied the human race. And even if the bombs had landed and Cyclo was no longer a menace, he had heard of other races out there in the universe, savage races, as pitiless as the Cyclos. How could this planet defend itself against those? It haunted him at every awakening. It plagued his sleep. People now looked so happy and industrious, so revived. What cruelty if it were just a brief interlude. How crushed they would be. Today would be just another day. He would get up, and a Russian attendant would bring in his breakfast and help Chrissy straighten the room. Then McKendrick would come, and they would exercise his arm, and he would try to walk a bit. Something about there being nothing wrong, really, just having to learn to do it again. Then Sir Robert or the parson would come over and sit uncomfortably for a while until Chrissy shooed them out. A few more dull routine actions, and another day would be gone. His failure oppressed him. He saw more clearly than they did how cruel a letdown this would be if the Cyclos counterattacked. He felt a little guilty when he saw a glad face. How soon it might turn to grief. He had given the historian, Dr. McDermott, a colorless outline of the drone destruction, all from the viewpoint of what one could or could not do if another one appeared. And Dr. Mack had well supposed there was far more to the action than that, but he had been chased out by Chrissy. Chrissy had just washed his face, and he was sitting at a trolley table when he noticed something odd going on with the Russian attendant. It really did not thoroughly challenge Johnny's interest, for there were always Scots guarding him in the outside passage against intruders or disturbance. A guard, he had at first protested and then accepted when they all seemed so upset at the refusal. Johnny had not seen this particular Russian in 2 weeks. Others had been taking his place. Once, this Russian had come in with a great big black eye and a triumphant grin on his face. Questioned, Chrissy had explained that the Russians sometimes fought among themselves over the right to serve him. Well, this fellow looked like he could win any fight. As tall as Johnny, heavy-set, with slightly slanted eyes, and dressed in baggy-bottom trousers and a white tunic, he was quite imposing, his bristling black mustache standing straight out on both sides of his big nose. His name was, inevitably, Ivan. After putting down the breakfast, he had drawn back and was standing there at the stiffest attention Johnny had ever seen. A coordinator came slipping in the door, the Scots sentry scowling and privately vowing to send for Sir Robert by runner the moment the door was closed. Johnny looked at the Russian questioningly. The Russian bowed from the hips and straightened up, looking stiffly ahead.
"How do you do, Johnny Tyler, sir?"
His was a very thick accent. He did not go on. Johnny went on eating oatmeal and cream.
"How do you do?" he said indifferently.
The Russian just stood there. Then his eyes rolled appealingly at the Scot coordinator.
"That's all the English he knows, Johnny, sir. He has some news and a present for you."
Chrissy, with a broom in her hand, her corn silk hair tied out of her eyes with a buckskin thong, bristled at this violation of proper announcement. She looked like she was going to hit both of them with the broom. Johnny motioned her to be still. He was slightly interested. The Russian was so imposing and was fairly bursting with what he had to say. Ivan barked off a long string of Russian, and the coordinator took it up.
"He says he is Colonel Ivan Smolensk of the Hindu Kush. That's in the Himalayan mountains. They are descended from a Red Army detachment that was cut off there and intermarried locally. There are about 10 groups in the Himalayas. Some speak Russian, some in Afghanistan dialect. They really aren't army units. Colonel to them means father. they're really Cossacks?
The Russian thought this was going on too long. It was more than he had said. So he rattled off another string. The coordinator cleared up a couple of points and turned to Johnny.
This is very irregular, said Chrissy, her black eyes flashing.
The coordinator was already in awe of Chrissy, and Johnny had to tell him to go on.
It seems like when they found they could travel around, the steps there are huge. A troop, that's their name for a family unit, rode clear over to the Ural Mountains.
They got on the radio to him. Anybody can use a radio, it seems. And they gave him some news. Our coordinator there had told them about this base, and that troop for some reason thought there might be a Russian base. They came back and radioed Ivan here about it, and he took off. Anybody can hook a ride on a plane. They schedule round the various tribes about once a week. And he rode like the wind, he says, on their very swift horses, and he went to check it personally, and he's just come back and wants to tell you.
He should tell the council, said Chrissy. Johnny is in no condition to be holding what they call audiences.
The Russian let out another string. The coordinator timidly translated. He did not like crossing Chrissy. She was such a beautiful woman and such a celebrity herself.
There is such a base. It is as big as this one and just as full of atom bombs and hardware and dead men.
Johnny was vaguely interested. Might serve them as a refuge if there were a counterattack. Well, tell him that's fine, and why not clean it up and use it? A brief interchange between the coordinator and the Russian, and then fireworks. Russians splattered off the very walls. Robert the Fox came in, short of breath from hurrying, thoroughly disapproving of anyone disturbing Johnny, as well as short-circuiting proper channels. But he paused. Johnny seemed interested. Not much, but more than Robert had seen for a while. The veteran leaned back against the wall and signaled the coordinator to go on. The coordinator was getting overwhelmed. He was quite used to dealing with important tribal heads and notables, but here he was in the company of three of the most important names this planet had ever had, especially Johnny, sir. But Colonel Ivan was almost stomping his feet for him to translate.
He says that's what ruined the whole human race. He says the valiant Red Army trying to fight the capitalist imperialist warmongers. These are just names to him, Johnny, sir. He doesn't have a political axe to grind. Had their attention on each other and didn't cooperate when an invader landed. And he says while tribal wars will and do happen, international wars among whole peoples are against the good welfare of the people. He says he is for the people of Earth, and people didn't stick together but fought, and this must not happen again. He's very emphatic, Johnny, sir, and he says all the other Russian tribes are also.
Johnny pushed back the tray, and the Russian, suddenly remembering his duty, picked it up. He let out another broadside of Russian. The coordinator pulled out some papers.
They've retained literacy, sir, and he and some of the chiefs drew up some papers. They don't have much paper, so excuse the condition. I think they found it in that base, and they want your agreement to it.
Johnny looked tired to Robert the Fox.
This is council business. The Himalayan chiefs are members of the council.
The Russian seemed to divine what he was saying and rattled off more Russian.
He says no, said the coordinator. This council is over here on this continent, and that base is over there on that continent. He says there are silos of nuclear weapons aimed at this continent, and have been for 1,000 years or so. And he doesn't want anything to happen to you, Johnny, sir. So he wants a force of South Americans and Alaskans, he knows there are almost no North Americans left, to take charge of that base over there on your authority. He says if the Russians have charge of this base here, they won't fire at Russia. And if the people from this continent take charge of that base there, they won't fire on this continent. They've got it all worked out, Johnny, sir. It's all here. They worked it out in Russian. If you say all right, and put a little initial here.
Robert the Fox was watching Johnny. This was the first thing he'd seen the lad take even the slightest interest in. Robert knew it would probably be all right with the council. He saw Johnny looking at him. He nodded.
Johnny took the offered pen and wrote his initials on the paper. The Russian seemed to almost deflate with relief. Then he rattled away at the coordinator, who presently said,
"He now has a present for you."
Ivan put down the tray and reached into his tunic pocket. He brought out a gold disc with a big red star in the center of it and two lapel tabs of ancient braid. He gave them to Johnny, waiting for him to accept. The coordinator said,
"That is the cap ornament they found on the Marshal of the Red Army, who was in charge of that base, and those are his lapel tabs. He wants you to know that they are yours, and you are in charge of both bases."
Johnny smiled slightly, and the Russian promptly kissed him on both cheeks and rushed out. Robert the Fox was holding the papers, and Chrissy put the gifts in Johnny's buckskin pouch.
"If this had happened 1,000 or so years ago," said Robert the Fox, "maybe things would have been different."
Chrissy was shooing him to leave. Johnny looked tired.
"The Council will put this through and handle it. There might be vital materials in that base."
"You might get it cleaned up and filtered," said Johnny. "It might help them if gas drones come again." When Dr. McKendrick came to exercise his arm and get him to walk, he told Johnny he was improved. Johnny alarmed him.
"Not improved enough," said Johnny, a bit bitterly. "I may not have been so smart after all."
Chapter 16 1 Turl sat in his dark hole and was gloomy. He was not with the other cyclos. They would have torn him to fur fluffs. He was here in a cubicle that had once been used for cleaning supplies on the dormitories. It had been rigged with a breathe gas circulator. It contained a narrow 12-foot-long bed. There was a little port that had been rigged to push food through. One could see the outside corridor beyond its revolving panes. And there was a two-way intercom inset below the door. The place was strong enough. He had already tried every means of opening it and escaping. He was not chained, but every hour of the day and night, there was a sentry with an assault rifle just outside. It was really the fault of the females, both the animal females and Chirk. His hindsight was a bit faulty, but not his conviction that it was correct. Always a master of self-delusion, Turl was at his best these days. When he compared his present lot with the beautiful dream of being wealthy and powerful on Cyclo, being bowed to by the royalty and trembled at by everyone else, he quivered with suppressed rage. These animals were denying him his due. 10 beautiful gold coffin lids lay moldering in the company cemetery on Cyclo. Of that he was utterly certain. The delicious thought of slipping out there some dark night and exhuming them was second only to the thought of the wealth and power that would ensue. He had befriended these animals. And how had they treated him? A mop closet. But Turl was nothing if not clever. He roused himself now and began to think hard and brightly. Now was the time to be the calm, cool, masterful Turl. He would get to Cyclo. He would get these animals and this planet destroyed, finally and forever. He would dig up those coffins. He would be bowed to and trembled at. Nothing must stand in his way. He began to tally up the bits and scraps of leverage he had. First, of course, it went without saying that his own cleverness was his chief asset. He agreed with himself on that. Second, he was almost certain the first animal he had caught had forgotten that there was a hefty charge of explosive left buried in that cage. Third, there had been 3 remotes. One was still in his office. One had been seized. But the third was just inside that cage door in case he somehow got tricked or trapped in there. That third one would have enabled him to blow up the females or shut off the power to the bars, and he was certain it had not been found. The fourth piece of leverage was a pretty big one, and the fifth was gigantic. Leverage. Sitting there in the semi-dark, he thought and thought. And after several days, he knew he had it. Every point in its torturous pattern of events was perfectly channeled, perfectly conceived, and ready to be put in train. The primary stage was to get himself put in that cage. Good. He would do it.
So it was that a very mild, personable Turl noted one morning that the sentries no longer wore kilts. Gazing out through the revolving panes of the food slot, he carefully concealed his elation. He sized the creature up. It had long pants, strapped boots, and a half-wing insignia on its left breast. Turl might be a top graduate of company schools, but he was no linguist. That was part of the arts, and what self-respecting Cyclo had anything to do with those? So an element of luck had to enter in here.
"What?" said Turl and Cyclo through the intercom installed in the door. "Does that half-wing stand for?"
The sentry looked a bit startled.
"Good," thought Turl. "I should have thought it would have two wings," said Turl.
"That's for a full pilot," said the sentry. "I'm just a student pilot, but I'll have my full wings some day."
Turl laid aside his conviction that you couldn't understand animals. While arrogance demanded non-recognition of them, necessity demanded he recognize them. This thing was talking Cyclo, Chinko accent, as would be expected, but Cyclo.
"I am sure you will earn your wings," said Turl. "I must say your Cyclo is excellent. You should practice it more, though. Talking to a real Cyclo would help."
The sentry brightened up. Suddenly he realized that that was perfectly true, and here was a real Cyclo. He had never talked to one before. It was quite a novelty. So he told Turl who he was, that being easy to discuss. He said he was Lars Thorensen, part of the Swedish contingent that had arrived some months ago for pilot training. He did not share the ferocity of some of the Scots against the Cyclos, for his people, way up in the Arctic, hadn't had any previous contact with Cyclos. He thought maybe the Scots exaggerated things a bit. And by the way, was Turl a flyer?
"Oh yes," Turl told him, and it was quite true.
Turl was a past master in all types of flight, battle tactics, and stunts like flying right down into 5-mile-deep mine shafts and picking up an endangered machine. The sentry had drawn closer. Flight was very dear to him, and here was a master. He said that their best flyer was Johnny, and did Turl know him?
"Oh yes, Turl not only knew him, but back in the old days, before there had been a misunderstanding, he himself had taught that one a few tricks. It was why he was such a good flyer. A very fine creature, actually. Turl had been his firmest friend."
Turl was elated. These were cadet sentries, standing watches in addition to their schooling to ease the considerable load on regular personnel. For several days each morning, Lars Thorensen improved his Cyclo and learned the ins and outs of combat flying. From a master and a one-time friend of Johnny's, he was quite unaware that if he put some of these tricks into use, he would lose the most elementary fight in the air, and later others would have to shake the nonsense out of him before he got himself killed. Turl knew it was a risk to play this trick, but he just couldn't resist it. Turl corrected the sentry's Cyclo up to a point, and then one morning he said to himself he would have to exactly clarify certain words, and really they should have a dictionary. There were lots of dictionaries, and so the next morning the sentry gave him one. With considerable glee, Turl went to work with the dictionary when the sentry was off duty. There were a lot of words in the composite language called Cyclo that were never actually used by Cyclos. They had leaked into the language from Chinko and other tongues. Cyclos never used them because they could not really grasp their conceptual meaning. So Turl looked up words and phrases like atone for wrongs, guilt, restitution, personal fault, pity, cruelty, just, and amends. He knew they existed as words and that alien races used them. It was a very, very hard job, and later he would look on this as the toughest part of his whole project. It was all so foreign, so utterly alien. Soon, Turl was satisfied he was ready to enter his next stage.
"You know," he said to the sentry one morning, "I feel very guilty about putting your poor Johnny in a cage. Actually, I have a craving to atone for my wrongs. It was my personal fault that he was subjected to such cruelty, and I wish with all my heart to make amends."
I am overwhelmed by guilt, and I pity him for what I did. And it would be only just if I made restitution for it all by suffering in a cage like he did.
It made Turl perspire to get it all out, but that only added to his contrite look. The sentry had made a habit of recording their conversations, for he studied them later and corrected his own pronunciation. And since he had never heard a lot of these words in Cyclo before, he was glad he had it all on disk. Turl was also glad. It had been an agonizing performance. The sentry, having the evening free, digested all this. He decided he had better report it to the compound commanding officer. There was a new compound commander, an Argyle, very well noted for his prowess in raids in earlier days, and very experienced, but not in America. The ease with which a radiation bullet could blow up a cyclo had given him a bit of contempt for them in their current state. And he had a problem of his own. Literal mobs of people from all over the world got off planes and took tours of the compound. The coordinators showed them around and pointed out where this had happened and that had happened. Many-hued and many-tongued, they were a bit of a nuisance, and almost every one of them wanted to be shown a cyclo. Most had never seen one, no matter that they had been oppressed by them for ages. Some very important chiefs and dignitaries had enough whip with the council to get special permission. That meant an extra detail of guards the commander did not have. It meant taking people down into the dormitory levels where they should not be. It actually meant a bit of danger to them, for some of those cyclos down there were not reconstructed. So the commander toyed with this idea. He went out and looked at the cage. Evidently, it could be wired. In fact, it was wired, with plenty of voltage to the bars. If one put up a protector in front so people would not touch the bars and get hurt, he would be relieved of these nonsense tours into the dormitory. Further, it appealed to him to have a monkey in a cage. It would help morale. And it would be an added attraction. He could plainly see that somebody might want to make restitution and do amends. So he mentioned it sketchily to a council meeting. They were very busy and had their minds on other things, and he omitted to tell them it was Turl. Technicians checked to make sure the cage wiring was live and could be shut off easily from the outside where the connections and box had been fastened to a pole, and that a barrier was erected to keep people from electrocuting themselves. It was a very elated, but carefully downcast, Turl, who was then escorted under heavy guard and put in Johnny's and the girl's old cage.
"Ah, the sky again," said Turl. He hated the blue sky of Earth like poison gas. "But I must take no pleasure in it. It is only just that I will be confined here, exposed to public view and ridicule." He had looked up some new words. "And mocked. It serves me right."
And so Turl went about his duty very honestly. The crowds came, and he looked ferocious and leaped about, glaring at them through his breathe mask glass, and making little children scream and flinch outside the barricade. He had heard of gorillas, beasts over in Africa, beating their chests, so he beat his chest. It was a real hit. The crowds came, they saw an actual cyclo, they even threw things at him. They had heard that he put Johnny in a collar, and young Lars visited him one day and told him, through the bars, that the crowd wanted to know where his collar was. Turl thought that a great idea. A couple of days later, five guards came in and put a heavy iron collar and chain on Turl and fastened him to the old stake. The compound commander was quite happy about it, but he told the guards that if Turl showed any sign at all of trying to escape, they were to riddle him. Turl's mouth bones wore a private smile as he capered and postured. He rumbled and roared. His plans were working out perfectly. 2. Johnny threw the book from him and pushed away his lunch untouched. The guard at the door looked in through the glass, abruptly alert. Colonel Ivan whirled in an automatic response, combat ready. It had sounded like the thud of a grenade for a moment.
"It makes no sense," said Johnny to himself. "It just makes no sense."
The others, seeing it was no emergency, relaxed. The sentry returned to his usual position, and the colonel went on wiping down the white tile. But Chrissy remained alarmed. It was almost unheard of for Johnny to be irritable, and for days and days now, ever since he had started to do nothing but study books, cyclo books they seemed to be, though she could not read, he had been getting worse and worse. The untouched lunch worried her. It was venison stew with wild herbs cooked especially for him by Aunt Ellen. Weeks ago, she had rushed to the old base to give him a glad and relieved greeting, and to tell him that though her fears for him had almost come true, here he was alive. She had stood around, suffused with delight, until she suddenly saw what they were feeding him. The old village was only a few miles away down the pass, and either personally or through a small boy mounted on one of the horses Johnny had left, Aunt Ellen routinely sent him his favorite dishes to be warmed up and served from the hospital galley. The boy or Aunt Ellen usually waited to take back the utensils, and when Aunt Ellen saw the food had not been touched, she would be upset. Chrissy vowed to get the sentry to eat some and maybe gobble a few bites herself. It wouldn't be polite to send back an untouched venison stew. Had he been able to walk easily, Johnny would have gone over and kicked the book. Normally, he had vast respect for books, but not this one. It and several similar texts were all on the subject of the mathematics of teleportation. They seemed incomprehensible. Cyclo-arithmetic was bad enough. Johnny supposed that because cyclos had 6 talons on their right paws and 5 on their left, they had to go and choose 11 as their base. All their mathematics was structured around the number 11. Johnny had been told that human mathematics employed a decimal system, involving 10 as the radix. He wouldn't know. He only knew cyclo-mathematics. But these mathematics of teleportation soared above normal cyclo-arithmetic. The book he had just thrown down had begun to give him a headache, and these days his headaches had almost vanished. The book was called Elementary Principles of Integral Teleportation Equations. And if that was elementary, give him something complicated. Nothing added up in it at all. He pushed back from the metal dolly table and rose shakily, supporting himself with his left hand on the bed. "I," he said in a determined voice, "am going to get out of here. There's no sense just waiting around for the sky to fall in on us. Where is my shirt?" This was something new. The colonel went over to help Johnny stand, and Johnny brushed him away. He could stand by himself. Chrissy turned around in a flurry and opened 3 or 4 wrong bureau drawers. The colonel picked up a handful of assorted canes and sticks that stood in the corner and knocked half of them down. The sentry ordered to report any unusual happenings to Robert the Fox got on the radio phone right away. Johnny chose a knob carry. McKendrick had had him practicing with a lot of different canes. It was difficult because both his right arm and right leg were seemingly useless, and carrying a stick in the left hand and hopping on the left leg didn't work very well. The knob carry had been brought in as a gift from a chief in Africa who didn't know Johnny was crippled. The black wooden stick was beautifully carved. They used them as throwing weapons as well as canes. They must be big men down there because it was the right length. It also had a comfortable palm grip. Johnny hobbled over to the bureau and half sat on it and got rid of the military hospital robe. Chrissy had found 3 buckskin shirts, and some perverseness made him select the oldest and greasiest one. He got it over his head and let her lace the thongs across the front of it. He got into some buckskin pants, and Chrissy helped him with a pair of moccasins. He struggled with a drawer and got it open. One of the shoemakers had made him a left-handed holster and had more properly fitted the old gold belt buckle to a wide belt. He put them on over the shirt. The holster had a .457 Magnum Smith & Wesson on it with radiation slugs, and he lifted it out and laid it back in the drawer and got out a small blast gun, made sure it was charged, and dropped it in the holster. At the colonel's odd look, Johnny said, "I'm not going to kill any cyclos today."
He was engaged in stuffing his right hand into the belt to get it out of the way, that arm tended to dangle, when an uproar broke out in the passageway. Johnny was intent on leaving, so he gave it little heed. It would be just Robert the Fox or the parson rushing over to fuss at him about council business. But it wasn't. The door burst open, and the base officer of the day, a big middle-aged Scot in kilts and claymore, a man named Captain Macduff, rushed in.
"Johnny, sir," said Macduff.
Johnny had the definite impression they were objecting to his leaving, and he was about to be impolite when the captain sputtered the rest of the message.
"Johnny, sir, did you send for a cyclo?"
Johnny was looking for a fur cap to wear. They had shaved his hair off for those operations, and he felt like a singed puma bareheaded. Then the import of the question hit him. He got the knob carry and unsteadily hitched forward and peered out the door. There stood Care. And in the glaring mine lamps out there, he was a very bedraggled creature. Care's fur was matted with filth clinging to it. His fangs, seen through the faceplate, were yellow and stained. His tunic was all ripped down one side, and he had on only one boot, no cap. Even his ear bones looked messed up. They had put four chains on him with a soldier at the far end of each one. It looked so overdone on the midget cyclo.
"Poor Care," said Johnny.
"Did you send for him, Johnny, sir?" demanded Captain Macduff.
"Bring him in here," said Johnny, leaning back against the bureau. He felt amusement mingling with pity.
"Do you think that's wise?" said Macduff.
But he waved them forward. Johnny told the soldiers to drop the ends of the chains and leave. Four more soldiers he hadn't noticed backed up, assault rifles trained on Care. He told them all to leave. The colonel was flabbergasted. Chrissy wrinkled her nose. What a stink. She'd have to clean and air the whole place. No one wanted to go. Johnny saw the pleading look through Care's breathe mask. He waved them all out, and it was with enormous reluctance that they closed the door.
"I had to tell the lie," said Care. "I just had to see you, Johnny."
"You sure haven't put a comb to yourself lately," said Johnny.
"It's a devil's cauldron they've got me in," said Care. "I'm half crazy these days. I dropped from his planet ship down to gooey dirt, Johnny. I got only one shaft mate, and that's you, Johnny."
"I don't know how or why you got yourself here, but..."
"It's this."
Care dove a dirty paw inside his torn shirt, oblivious of the fact that a more nervous Johnny might have shot him. Johnny could draw, if a trifle slowly, with his left hand. But Johnny knew Care. Held before Johnny's eyes was a banknote. He took it with some curiosity. He had only seen these at a distance in the hands of cyclos paying off wagers, and he had never held one before. He knew they were a basic symbol of exchange and greatly valued. It was about 6 inches wide and a foot long. The paper felt a bit rough, but it seemed to glow. One side of it was printed in blue and the other side in orange. It had a nebula pattern and bright starburst on it. But the remarkable thing was that it was worded in what must be 30 languages, 30 numeral systems, 30 different types of lettering. Ah, one of them was Cyclo. Johnny could read that. He read, "The Galactic Bank," and 100 Galactic Credits, and "Guaranteed Legal Tender for All Transactions," and "Counterfeiters Will Be Vaporized," and "Certified Exchangeable at the Galactic Bank on Presentation." It had a picture of somebody, or something, on the blue side. It looked like a humanoid, or maybe a tall nap somebody had mistaken Donald Dean for, or maybe, who knew? The face was very dignified, the very portrait of integrity. On the reverse, it had a similar-sized picture of an imposing building with innumerable arches. All very interesting, but Johnny had determined to do other things today. He gave it back to Care and started to fish out his own cap again. He felt sort of embarrassed with such a shaved head. Care looked a bit let down.
"That's 100 credits,"
said Kerr.
It isn't a cyclobank. The cyclos and everybody else use those. It's not counterfeit.